Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. In early 1997, the United Network of Organ Sharing, or UNOS, publicly addressed a viral email chain that was warning travelers about the dangers of organ theft. The email claimed people were being kidnapped and drugged, only to wake up in a bathtub filled with ice and either one or both of their kidneys removed. UNOS dismissed the emails as a hoax and cited the work of a Washington Post reporter who, in 1991, traced the origin of the myth to a rejected movie script. Since the mid-1980s, UNOS has been tracking reports of organ theft and claims to have found no evidence to support such rumors. And yet, organ theft horror stories persist in the United States and abroad. Anthropologist Nancy Shepper Hughes spent her career investigating the worldwide rumors about a global market for human organs and tissues and found that the stories were, quote, true at that indeterminate level between fact and metaphor. Ethan Waters is a journalist who has contributed to the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, and Esquire, among others. He profiled Nancy Shepper Hughes for Pacific Standard's medical issue in an article titled The Organ Detective. Ethan, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
So let's start with, how exactly did Shepper Hughes first begin her investigation on organ theft?
Well, the rumors came to her when she was down in Brazil working on her now very well-known book called Death Without Weeping. And she was down there documenting poverty in Brazil and the high death rates among children and the ways in which the medical establishment wasn't helping very much down there. And among her sources, she began to hear these stories of vans along dirt roads picking up children and then the children's bodies later turning up in dumpsters and on the roadsides, you know, eviscerated from their organs. And the local population was just certain that these children were being kidnapped and murdered for their organs. So Nancy, being that she was charting the death records and going to the, you know, the cemeteries and the mortuaries every day, had a good reason to be skeptical about these stories. She was seeing no eviscerated bodies show up. When she wrote about it later in Death Without Weeping, she ended up coming to the conclusion that these stories were not, in fact, literally true, but they were true at the intermediate level, as you say, between fact and metaphor, by which she said that they spoke to the other difficulties that this population went through and their really troubled relationship with the medical establishment. She wasn't going to dismiss them, but there was no actual evidence of children being murdered for their organs.
So the idea is that healthcare is a service that works primarily for the elite, people with money, and because of that, these stories were sort of generated out of fear?
Out of fear and out of the fact that was exactly true, that this population knew that the healthcare benefited the rich and by and large left them to die in many cases when they could have been helped.
Organ donation was really just an experimental procedure still in the 70s. So at what point did the market for an organ trade become a real worldwide market in the first place?
So in the early and mid-90s, the technology really began to spread around the world. It spread across Asia and then throughout the United States. And then there was a drug called cyclosporine that came online that helped with the rejection of organs, which basically increased the ability of people to get organs from many more people than they would have otherwise. And that at that point, it really began to spread around the world. And the technology spread much faster than the laws and understandings and ways of thinking about it. So there was a great deal of controversy over the 90s as to where these organs were coming from, what constituted brain death, whether you could take organs from dead bodies. And there was a lot of controversy, so the medical establishment on sort of a global scale had to really run to catch up with the spread of this brand new technology.
So in your article, you sort of profile Shepper Hughes crisscrossing the globe looking for evidence of an organ black market, which, of course, is a black market. In 1984, the National Organ Transplant Act outlawed the sale of human organs, at least in the U.S., but Shepper Hughes did manage to find some evidence of people buying and selling kidneys here in the United States. How was she able to find that link?
Well, the turn really came in the mid-90s when she went to a conference with a lot of other transplant surgeons, and she was asked to address these rumors. And in the process of talking about these rumors, she began to realize that there was indeed a great deal of controversy about how organs were being procured. There was a black market where people were being paid for things like kidneys. There was tremendous abuses within mortuaries where people would take not the live organs, like hearts and kidneys, but skin and tissue and cornea from dead bodies all over the world. And she began to realize that this was really a rich area for an anthropologist to begin to try to understand what was going on a global scale. And indeed, as you say, she began to travel the world aggressively, going to Moldova and the Philippines and South Africa and Brazil, trying to chart mainly the kidney trade, which is, of course, the trade where you can sell one of your kidneys and have another one that still works. And there was a tremendous sort of multicultural, multi-border black market. And Nancy worked exceedingly hard for many, many years to try to sort of put her finger on what was going on and how those interconnections were happening, who the brokers were, who the surgeons were. And eventually, she did managed to trace it to American shores, and she got basically an email at one point from someone inside an organization called United Lifeline, and he basically disclosed to her that this was a organization that brought pairs of people to the United States to major hospitals, and it would be a donor and a recipient. They'd come to a hospital and say, "We have this donor that wants to altruistically give to this recipient. We'll pay basically cash for this procedure. There'll be no insurance. It'll all be profits for the hospital." And indeed, what was happening was that that donor was often getting paid, was always getting paid, which is illegal by U.S. and most international laws.
I'm speaking with the journalist Ethan Waters about the illegal organ trade, which has long been the focus of anthropologist Nancy Shepherd Hughes. Now, we think of anthropologists being, conventionally speaking anyway, objective as, I guess, putting science first. But Nancy was actually instrumental in getting the head of United Lifeline, a man named Isaac Rosenbaum, indicted for his role in brokering illegal organs.
Yes. So Nancy, by her own admission, bends a lot of the conventional rules of anthropology. And to her great credit, she addresses these the ways in which she is, you know, outside the norm. One of the ways she's outside the norm certainly is the idea that you would take your source material and turn around and take it straight to law enforcement. And a lot of other people in anthropology would say, "I would never do that." Nancy was looking at it and saying, "I see an international crime going on here. I see donors being exploited. I see them getting no aftercare. This is something that I have to intervene with, and I am not going to let ideas of professional ethics get in the way of me stopping something that is really, truly a tragedy." This is not the only way she's pushed the boundaries of anthropology and social science. She has done things like basically gone undercover. She's gone to places and claimed to be a person that was looking for a kidney, that wanted to buy a kidney. She's negotiated the price with, you know, potential donors. She's walked into hospitals, you know, saying, like, "I'm Dr. Shepherd Hughes and I need this information," assuming that people weren't going to understand that doctor there was her PhD in anthropology.
This is not this does not sound like the life of an academic. This sounds like the life of a police officer.
She really is her own, you know, there's no one in the anthropology world that I can really compare her to. She has this idea of what she calls being a militant anthropologist. And that idea goes all the way back to long before she started in the organ world, actually, when she tried to rally everyone in the profession to, as she puts it, to sort of become class traitors, to push against bourgeois institutions like universities and hospitals, and to express solidarity with the sources and basically join them in their fights against oppression. And she's had a great deal of influence over the practice of anthropology. There are a lot of people in the profession that think very highly of her, and indeed there's a lot of people in the profession that think that she's dragging the profession into sort of a moral model of anthropology, and you're not really actually, you know, studying the world in the appropriate shades of gray.
You've been following Shepherd Hughes for a few years now, and you actually joined her at the sentencing hearing for Rosenbaum 2 summers ago. What were those testimonies like, and what was her response?
So Rosenbaum got sentenced a couple years ago in a court in New Jersey, and I accompanied Nancy into the hearing, and there was testimony by a doctor from Albert Einstein Hospital. There was testimony by a donor who had been paid for his kidney. There was testimony by a family member of the person that received the organ. And it was very interesting because Nancy, as we sat there, you know, had sort of a disparaging comment for every character in the courtroom. She really felt like that the doctor was not being fully disclosing what he knew. She felt the prosecution wasn't asking the right questions. She felt the family member, you know, could have donated her own organ instead of buying one. It was kind of remarkable, and it reminded me of something that Nancy wrote very early on in her career about what a medical anthropologist should do. She said, a medical anthropologist should become a court jester. It should become the mocking and dissenting voice from the sidelines. And I realized sort of as I was sitting there that she'd almost become exactly that for me, this sort of mocking court jester, making disparaging comments about everyone in the courtroom. It was a really interesting moment.
Throughout the article, you get the sense that Nancy finds empathy with virtually everybody in the black market organ process. We're talking about the donor, the recipient, even the brokers, the people who arrange transplants, but not so much the doctors. And it seems so strange that given that she operates in these shades of gray, you know, that she's, you know, at some times an anthropologist, at some times an interrogator, at some times an undercover cop, that she wouldn't be able to find the shades of gray and the nuance for the doctors and surgeons who are actually conducting transplants.
Right. I noticed that in her work as well. So when she talks about the brokers and when she talks about the donors, and she has this remarkable ability to see detail, to pick up nuances. It's when she steps back and she talks about the transplant community and she says things like, the transplant community is like child abusing priests, that they protect their own in this way. And she said things like, doctors are creating a need for organs that don't exist. And transplant technology is the modern form of human sacrifice. Like, it's these moments when she steps back and looks at the transplant community that her rhetoric becomes really white hot and almost, almost sounds like the trailer for a horror movie at times. It's so outlandish. And it does stand in contrast, in my mind, to that more subtle work that she does for the donor, for the broker, her really good work of exposing this world that people really didn't understand or know existed. I'm much more impressed by the on-the-ground anthropology she does than that global view of the transplant world.
Well, Ethan, thank you so much for talking about this with us today.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me on.
Ethan Waters is a journalist who has contributed to the New York Times Magazine, Mother Jones, and Esquire, among others. He wrote about anthropologist Nancy Shepper Hughes for Pacific Standard's Medical Issue. And you can find a link to that article, The Organ Detective, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us. After a break, we're going to talk about transplant tourism. That's when sick individuals in need of new organs travel or sometimes relocate their entire families to places where they're more likely to receive one. That story's coming up when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott today. Seeking health care is often an exercise in patience. Waiting is standard practice in doctor's offices and emergency rooms, and often the best prescription for minor maladies like sprains, flus, and headaches is to just wait it out. Possibly the worst waiting game in healthcare is that endured by people in need of an organ transplant. In such cases, a match is out of anyone's control. Producer Meg Heckman reports.
The phone call came the night before Thanksgiving, when Jim McHugh was on his way to a party for his son's football team. It was Jim's doctor, and he had some bad news.
And they informed me that they had found a tumor on my liver, and it was substantial, and that they had already put into the works for me to be on the transplant list.
Liver cancer is often fatal, but Jim had many reasons to be optimistic. His wife, Terry, is a nurse. He had health insurance, great doctors, and aside from the cancer, was in decent shape. But there was one big thing working against him: geography. For about 40 years, donated organs have been distributed based on location. The demand for organs far outweighs the supply everywhere, but the wait for livers is especially long in New England, New York, and California. This leaves patients like Jim with a difficult choice: move or die. Frederick Gordon is the director of liver transplantation and hepatology at the Leahy Clinic in Burlington, Massachusetts. He's part of a group of physicians advocating for policy changes that he says will make the transplant process more fair.
Over time, you know, the population has changed, the demographics have changed, the need for organs have changed, and so now there's huge disparities throughout the country in terms of waiting time, which probably in the beginning were very equal across the board.
The size of the waiting list changes daily, but the American Liver Foundation estimates that roughly 1,100 New England residents will be placed on the list each year. Fewer than 300 will get the transplant they need. For Jim McHugh, moving to another state was his last chance. The tumor in his liver was growing fast. If it got too big, he wouldn't be eligible for a transplant. By February, Jim had an appointment at the Clarion Transplant Center in Indianapolis.
I was picturing moving to a different part of the country and living someplace and, you know, hoping for a phone call. It just didn't seem like a really good odds in my favor.
It's difficult to know exactly how many other patients have made similar decisions, but it's a trend doctors suspect is on the rise. Some patients even look beyond the borders of the United States, engaging in what's called transplant tourism by traveling to India or China to illegally buy the organs they need. Jim McHugh wasn't that kind of transplant tourist, but he was about to become a stranger in a strange land, a Patriots fan headed for Colts territory and hoping for a miracle. The first day went pretty much as Jim expected. The hospital staff was great, and Indianapolis seemed like a decent city. The second day was also uneventful, until one of Jim's doctors asked him to drop by the transplant ward.
And I was sitting in the waiting area of this transplant floor with my wife and my brother, and next thing I know, it was around 4 o'clock, and I see Dr. Techter coming down the hallway. He came up to me and said, "Let me see you for, I need to see you for a minute," and we walked into an adjacent room, and he told me to take my shirt off and lift up my arm, and he took his hands and he measured my abdomen top to bottom and then side to side. And at that point, he said, he asked me if I was ready to go. Get a little emotional because this part is hard because it's in a happy way because it's a fantastic memory. So anyways, I asked him, "What do you mean? Are we ready to go?" And he says, "Well, we have a liver for you."
A man had died in a car accident, and his liver was brought to the hospital. Three other patients on the transplant list had been called in, but each was disqualified from the surgery. The liver would spoil in a few hours, and outside, an ice storm made travel too dangerous for any other potential recipients. But Jim McHugh was there, and, as it turned out, he was a perfect match. Luck will always play a role in organ transplants, but Gordon wants to make the system a little more fair. He's on a committee that's been working on a new policy for liver distribution, one that will be ready for formal review sometime in the next year. But Gordon says not everyone agrees it's time for a change.
Now, when we try to make changes, there are groups like New England and New York and California who scream and yell that we need to change the system because it doesn't work and it's broken. And there are other groups that have shorter waiting times that say, you know, why mess around with the system that we all know and have been using for 40 years?
Jim, meanwhile, just celebrated the 5th anniversary of his liver transplant and his 25th wedding anniversary. He and his family are also working to improve other patients' odds by advocating organ donation.
That individual who was just gracious enough to check the box to be a liver donor, to be an organ donor, rather, was just an incredible, you know, thing for me. And to this day and for the rest of my life, I will be grateful for that. I've been able to see my daughter graduate from college, my son graduate from high school, have seen a lot of things I would not have been able to see if I didn't get lucky.
That piece was produced by Meg Heckman for Word of Mouth. You can find a transcript of her interview with Dr. Frederick Gordon and find out more about organ donation at wordofmouthradio.org. And an update to Megan's story. The Liver and Intestinal Organ Transplantation Committee of the United Network for Organ Sharing recently published a paper outlining changes to allocation that should reduce geographic disparities. Most significantly, they propose dividing the country into fewer but larger districts. And while this would ensure patients across the country greater access to donated organs, it has raised concerns in those regions that aren't experiencing long wait times, the fear being that wait times in those regions may increase as a result. The paper also does acknowledge that the best way to reduce geographic disparity is to raise the number of organ donors. The United Network for Organ Sharing is holding a public forum on the topic September 16th in Chicago. You can find a link to the paper on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Normally, we introduce our topics with a little exposition and context, but I'm going to cut right to the chase and tell you this next interview is straight up about back hair. Did that make you cringe? Well, you may be part of the problem. New York Magazine's Kat Steffel recently dove into the wild world of men's back hair removal and discovered it's far more common than you might expect and far more controversial than other types of hair removal. And a bit of warning, there are many types of hair removal, and we'll probably be talking about a few of them in the next few minutes. Kat Steffel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Thanks for joining us. So I'm going to start off with a little admission that my upper torso is pretty much naturally hairless. So this subject is totally new to me. Were you as surprised as I was to discover how big back hair removal has gotten?
Totally. You're blessed, first of all.
Thank you. I know it.
Because when you see shirtless guys in movies or, advertisements for Abercrombie & Fitch, they're totally hairless. I just assumed that most men were naturally back hairless. But recent essays by some writers for Slate and columnist Andrew Sullivan revealed that guys have been quietly waxing and narrowing and shaving each other, just like women.
It seems strange to me because, as opposed to hair removal for women, which is something, gets talked about a lot, we sort of all know that it happens, but this back hair phenomenon it's like a weird secret.
Yeah, there's definitely still some grooming stigma for a lot of men. I write mostly about women's issues, and pubic hair removal is like a perennial hot topic. Anytime you mention it, there's a comment section, hundreds of people deep talking about what it means to remove or not remove your pubic hair. So it was sort of shocking to see this silence surrounding the male equivalent.
I guess the idea here is that the same sort of controversy over the removal of pubic hair, that has become a central conversation topic for back hair. Is that pretty much the gist?
Basically, I would say that they're not quite equivalent yet, because as pubic hair removal has become both like more mainstream and more debated, women's magazines and women's media sort of represent an array of options and say, you do you. There's like a feminist element to the conversation.
Yeah.
But back hair is still pretty, there's still like really strict rules surrounding it. GQ said back hair is never sexy, which is just something a women's magazine could never get away with saying about, even about leg hair or armpit hair.
That's true.
You can't really say that about women's body hair because it's been politicized, but not so with back hair. Yet, I think that's changing. There's been some sort of recent discourse about it by gay writers who are trying to reclaim it.
Reclaim it how?
Mark Joseph Stern at Slate wrote that he not only is going to bare his own back hair in tank tops, which he was previously too ashamed to wear, but also he encouraged other gay men not to tease other men, gay or straight, for their back hair.
You also write that Seth Rogen is like a hero of the back hair movement, the pro back hair movement.
Right. One of my colleagues at Vulture.com observed that Seth Rogen had stopped waxing his back hair sometime in between Knocked Up and Neighbors.
That's so, and I want to go back and watch Knocked Up just to see his waxed back. I didn't even realize.
No, me neither. I mean, what my colleague at Vulture, Jesse David Fox, noticed that was so funny was that Seth Rogen would be covered in fur just until, you know, the halfway point, and then suddenly it all disappeared on his back, which in retrospect looks totally crazy, and I don't know why no one noticed.
So do you think it's men's magazines and movies primarily that seem to be driving the standard for a hairless male back?
Definitely. I don't know where else people would be getting the message, because in reality, if you go to the beach, a lot of guys have back hair.
Yeah. I think it's very funny that this trend would be happening concurrently with the pro-giant beard trend. You know, I mean, we've got giant beards, but I can imagine that a lot of the same sort of giant Brooklynite beards that you might see might be on hairy men who are waxing their backs, which just seems like a contradiction to me.
That's totally true. And there's a parallel thing happening with women and body hair. I know women who, you know, don't shave their armpits, but do shave their legs. Or my colleague at The Cut, Maureen O'Connor, wrote about something called the full bush Brazilian, which is women removing a lot of their pubic hair, but also leaving enough to still show that they're adult women and they have it. So people are definitely embracing hairiness in sort of measured ways.
I guess this, do you think this just goes to show you that, you know, you really are making a statement however you wear your hair, wherever that hair is, no matter what? Like, there is no such thing as non-political hair.
I tend to think so. I mean, I guess unless you go totally, totally ungroomed. But no, even then, it's always, yeah, you're always saying something. But I think what's interesting is that no matter what you say, someone will be into it.
Any examples? Like, Burt Reynolds' back hair, that was probably sexy back hair.
Yep, definitely. Who else? Roger Moore had back hair.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Kat Steffel, thank you so much for taking on this very bizarre topic with me. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Bye.
Bye. Kat Steffel wrote the article, Back Hair Surpasses Pubic Hair as Most Political Hair, for New York Magazine. You can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm bringing sexy back. Yeah. The mother boys don't know how to act. Special, what's behind your back? Yeah. So turn around and I'll pick up the slack. Okay, so we move now from back hair to backtracking. That's a little analyzed phenomenon that's become standard in the live music industry, and it's one that occasionally grates on producer Alex Kappelman, who, along with Whitney Jones, examined backtracking in this episode of their music podcast, Pitch.
So, Alex, set the scene for me here.
All right, so it's a beautiful night in Austin, Texas, in 2013. It's South by Southwest, and I'm seeing one of my favorite bands, Vampire Weekend. There's four of them on stage, and they're rocking out, and all of a sudden I hear this kind of fifth part, and I'm thinking, oh, is one of them playing some new crazy instrument that I can't really hear? Like, where is this part coming from? There's only four of them and there's five parts. All of a sudden, this disappointment and anger and just welling of emotions just flows up in my body, because I realize that they're playing to a backing track.
Pitch is our perception of frequency.
Pitch is how that note sounds when you hear.
Pitch is...
All right, so when I say backing track, here's what I mean. It's pre-recorded music that's being played underneath other live instrumentation. So, for example, in the live band that we were about to start...
We have been talking about, yes.
What was the name of that band, Whitney?
Moses and His Tabernacle Choir.
So when we start the Moses and His Tabernacle Choir band, I mean, I'm clearly going to be on drums. And what instrument were we going to play again?
Keytar,
right. So we'd need to fill out the sound a little bit, right? We'd maybe want a bass, maybe a guitar. We're not talking like Milli Vanilli over here where, like, we get, you know, two random people to record our parts and then we totally lip sync it underneath. We're talking about something that supplements our live instrumentation. All right, so let me play you an example of what this sounds like in practice. This is a track called Take the City by Avant La Va. They're an electropop band. There's a drummer, there's a keyboardist, and they have three singers. So this is what they all sound like, just the five of them playing live. Little bit crazy, And here's the backing track that they play underneath that. So when you're in the audience, here's what you're actually going to hear. All right, so that's both of them together, and that is definitely a lot fatter, you know, but still I come from like this tradition of like jam bands and classic rock bands, and you know, you worship guys like Jerry Garcia and Jimi Hendrix for being just phenomenal musicians. And I think, you know, if a band is good, they're good. You don't need a computer. The band Haim. They're blowing up right now. They're one of my favorite bands, too. They put on an amazing live show because it's just the three ladies and their drummer, no backing track, and they absolutely rock it. I still like the Vampire Weekend concert. They were really great performers. It was a great show. But the fact that they played with a backing track just, like, really, really bothered me. So I decided to find out why. And when I started learning about this stuff, I was mortified. It's not just Vampire Weekend. It's lots of other bands, too.
I mean, I think it's totally an industry standard at this point. I mean, it's totally accepted, now, especially now that it's made it in. It's really made its way in the indie world.
That's Ian Pei. Ian plays drums in Avant La Va, that band we just played. And he also creates the band's backing tracks. He's been making backing tracks for years now for acts like Blue Man Group, Fisher Spooner, and Cat Power. And he told me that pretty much everyone out there is playing to a track. Can you list some examples that you know for sure are doing it?
Well, Kanye, you know, Jay-Z. Pretty sure, yeah, Justin Timberlake, Madonna, you know. I mean, it's everywhere. It's on every rung of the ladder. I mean, you go to a smaller town or city, and if there's a guy in a bar playing with a guitar, a lot of times they have backing tracks. I mean, maybe it's not in the form of a computer. Maybe it's a sequencer. But it's the same thing.
Bands have been able to do this for a while. But it was expensive. And it wasn't until recently that this stuff became widely available.
I think that maybe 7-8 years ago, I first started seeing it show up in indie bands on tour and in festivals. And it was kind of a nightmare because the technology wasn't quite there. People didn't know how to put it together. Like, you know, we learned by screwing up a lot. Like, I had screensavers and like, you know, my computer would go to sleep after a certain amount of time. And I forget about this stuff in the beginning. And so we're playing in front of 50,000 people. My computer's plugged in not only to the sound system, but also to the video screen. And just like this giant beep goes off, and then my photo library is playing on a video screen in front of 50,000 people. And then you hear the audience kind of react to it. And I'm like, what the hell is going on? And then I look back, and there's like pictures of the band like on the beach in Ibiza.
I would have flipped out if I were at that show. A human being would never stop playing in the middle of a set to show photos of his entire family. But humans definitely have disadvantages too. They need to eat, they need to pay their bills, and that all costs money, which bands aren't necessarily going to be able to afford. So when backing tracks became more available, they started to replace humans.
I think it's, I think a lot of it's economics and practicality. I think that the way people are recording music now is much more complex. They're layering a lot of different sounds, and without those sounds, the song changes. And sometimes the songs are dependent on these all these layers. So they have to have these sounds to recreate it, but they can't have like 10 keyboard players.
We have this idea of the way that things should be, and then we know the way that things are.
That's Jennifer Lena. She's a sociology professor at Columbia who studies music.
And we often ask or expect that the bands that we care about, the acts that we care about, the art that we care about, do better than the way things are and try to approach the way things should be. But I think every time we blame individual performers for acting rational within the system that we have, we're kind of missing the structural point.
But that's, you could argue that, like, if you play live and you play with a backing track, people are going to see you live and they expect that you're a good live band. Like, the majority of people will go to a show and they'll have no idea that their backing track's there. Do you think it's important that bands display the computer on the line, like guitar, singer, computer? Or, you know, like, what happens if it's less? Like, how important is, you know what I'm trying to ask?
Yeah, I do. So I think there's a danger in the way that you frame the question of me agreeing with you that the way that you see the world is the way that everybody sees the world. That was actually sort of your premise of your question. And I didn't want to interrupt you to object. Not everybody expects the same things when they go to a live show. And that's actually exactly the character of music communities, is because everybody has a slightly different access point, meaning some people have liked the music for a while, others less so. Some heard it first in Detroit, others didn't. You know, because everybody has generated their own expectations of the style, not everybody at the same show has the same set of expectations of what counts as authentic on the stage.
And you're right. Like, I guess I am kind of a music snob. Like, I try not to be. Well, you shake your head.
Well, I think that's really pejorative, and I don't feel that way. I don't think you should feel that way about yourself. I think that music snob implies that you have mistaken ideas about what you should care about, and I don't hold that position. You should care about what you care about. I think the issue is when we project those expectations on others and aren't aware that we're doing that. It's not that I would judge that either. I think that's a pretty human response. It's just that I think, like, as a people, we don't move forward if we are not aware that that's how we operate in music scenes. I think that, you know, I don't want us to have an artistic culture where the majority of the conversations we have about the stuff that's really at stake for us is judging whether we're right or somebody else is right. I would much rather have a kind of arts ecology where we find all kinds of eccentricity, we find all kinds of differences, and we kind of rejoice in the fact that we live in a culture that can produce that much eccentricity and difference.
So thinking about all that stuff just zoomed me out a little bit, and now I have a little bit of perspective. You know, maybe I shouldn't be so hard on backing tracks or the musicians who use them. They're there for a reason. They can definitely help live shows. And it's not like backing tracks are going away anytime soon. But I still get excited by bands like Haim. I mean, they don't use a backing track, right?
I mean, it would be interesting. Like, we could, you know, we could check on YouTube and see some of their live shows, and we could figure out whether they're actually playing everything or not.
Can we do that right now?
Yeah.
Let's do it.
You know, you want to do it?
Let's do it.
Okay.
This song's called The Wire.
Oh yeah, I think they're actually really playing. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I couldn't detect it. I mean, I only listened to, like, you know, 30 seconds of a song, but yeah, it feels live.
Okay, and yeah. How does that make you feel?
I mean, you know, I still love hearing a live band. I think it's awesome. You know, I do enjoy it a little more, just a little more, when a band's playing the whole thing and they're really doing it. I know that you're gonna be okay.
That piece came from the podcast Pitch and was produced by Alex Kappelman and Whitney Jones. More from Pitch at wordofmouthradio.org. And after a quick break, we'll look at a 5-story building in Germany that is getting most of its power from algae. The future of algae power when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Most of us can grasp the concept of wind or solar power, but what about supplying the power for an entire building using algae? Algae biofuel has made headlines recently as an alternative to fossil fuels for cars and jets, and last year a 5-story building in Hamburg, Germany was covered with algae-filled panels to test its viability as an energy source for buildings. The results thus far have been fairly impressive, but will algae prove to be a practical way to power our homes? Ben Schiller is a staff writer for Fast Company's Coexist, where we found his article, "This Algae-Powered Building Actually Works." And Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me. So the title of your article sort of gets, I think, a little to the surprise that we might all feel when we hear about this concept. So I guess the question is, how does an algae-powered building actually work?
Well, that's a good question. So this building is, I should say, it's an apartment building. It has real people living inside. It's not some concept. And the way it works is on two sides, the south side and the west side, it's completely covered in these panels. They're about an inch thick. And throughout the day, these panels, it's kind of this green gunk, is pumped full of CO2, compressed CO2. And also these nutrients, and when the sunlight hits the panels, the algae multiplies and it gives off this heat, and then this heat can be captured by the building systems, and the actual biomass inside the panels can be captured as well and harvested, and that can be sold off for secondary uses like pharmaceutical products and some food products. So the idea is to have a completely enclosed system producing heat and secondary materials at the same time.
And yeah, like you said, it looks kind of funky, almost like a green rectangular lava lamp. So are we talking about this algae powering literally everything in the building, you know, lights, heat, everything?
No. At the moment, I think it's powering about 50% of the overall energy demand. There's also some solar panels on the roof. And I think there's some kind of CHP gas system as well, which is kind of backing the whole thing up. But the people behind this, who are very sophisticated European engineers, are hoping to gradually increase the output of the actual algae system. So I think over time that they might get somewhere near 100% for the overall building.
Now, you mentioned it's a residential building holding actual tenants. What do they think?
Real people. Well, I haven't spoken to them, but I think they're excited to be there. I mean, they get free energy because you know, it's being sponsored, and you know, it's pretty cool because you know, when they invite around their, you know, friends, it's obviously an aesthetic and kind of unusual thing to show them. So it's pretty exciting, I think.
Okay, so let's, I guess, just break down maybe the pros and the cons of using algae as a power source. What are the benefits, and what maybe would be the drawbacks?
Well, the benefit is, I mean, it's like a lot of you know, renewable production, like solar panels, for instance. You know, once you've installed the system, there's basically zero marginal cost to every extra sort of unit of energy you produce after that. So that's a tremendous benefit. There's also a benefit in sequestering CO2 because you're pumping CO2 into the system all day. I mean, it's not a huge benefit, but you've got the benefit actually from putting in the CO2 into the system, and also the benefit from the CO2 you're not producing from another source of energy production. So it's kind of double whammy there. And also that, I think it's also teaching the public about you know, energy production. It's a very kind of visible energy system out there, and I think it gets people thinking. It's educational.
Okay, so what about the drawbacks then? There's got to be some, right?
Well, the drawbacks is that this is a kind of first of its kind, and anything that's first of its kind is bound to be expensive. These are very specialist systems, and it takes a lot of engineering and maintenance and so on. It's not just like you know, turning on a switch in your garage and getting immediate power. So we're talking very high-end buildings, I think, that would have this, and some specialist applications. I mean, the guy I was talking to at the engineering company, Arup, was talking about possible applications in data centers, which are obviously extremely energy-hungry buildings, and they get very hot. So there's kind of two possible benefits there. One is that you, you know, offset some of your energy costs, but also these systems are very good at shading because when the sunlight hits the panel, it absorbs the sunlight and takes down the heat.
So you mentioned data centers. That makes a lot of sense to me. But I have to wonder, in terms of residential use, if they were trying to expand it, do you think people would be able to handle, you know, the sort of experimental look that these panels offer on a large scale? I mean, it's pretty cool, but at the same time, we're talking about green ooze on the side of a building.
Well, exactly. I think you've said it exactly. I think this is probably an acquired taste, something that you certain people would like and certain people would just think is the worst. Yeah, I think, as I said, I think it's specialist applications and specialist people that are going to want this.
Well, Ben Schiller, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks very much.
Ben Schiller is a staff writer for Fast Company's Coexist, where we found his article, "This Algae-Powered Building Actually Works." And you can find a link to the article where you can see some pictures of the building at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us, send us your feedback, or share your ideas for the program on Facebook and Twitter. Right now on Facebook, we're asking listeners their views on a topic we discussed earlier today, back hair. Should men wax their backs or let it all hang out? Let us know what you think. After all, the most fascinating conversations tend to take place via word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.